Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. For the second hour of today's show, we're going to look at a few creative projects focused on telling different narratives around incarceration. Up first, we're looking at the story of Lawrence Bartley, the subject of the most recent Death, Sex, and Money episode from October 3rd, titled, I Served 27 Years in Prison, Now I'm Out on Parole. It's a story of love, commitment, and contrition. Anna Sale, host and managing editor of Death, Sex, and Money, joins us to discuss the episode. And in studio, I have Lawrence Bartley himself. Anna spoke to him in 2014, then again last summer as he was getting ready to go before the parole board for the first time. Welcome to All of It, you guys.
Hey, hello.
Thanks. Hi, Lawrence.
Hi, Anna.
Oh, you guys are old pals at this point, right?
That's right.
So, Anna, how did you first meet Lawrence?
You know, it was through a colleague of mine in the WNYC newsroom who was covering Lawrence, a graduation ceremony up at Sing Sing, I think for a fatherhood program you had been through. And his name is Robert Lewis, the reporter, and he said, I think this guy, Lawrence Bartley, is worth doing a longer interview with. He's got quite a story. And I went up to Sing Sing, and Lawrence, we sat and we talked for a long time about your crime back in 1990. We talked about your family. We talked about you getting married and having two small boys while you were incarcerated. And I've since met his wife, Renine, been to the house where they're living now, and then talked to them together a few months after Lawrence got out on parole this spring.
All right, Lawrence, we're going to talk about you like you're not here for just a second. And a journalist, what was it about about Lawrence's story that made you realize this was special and needed to be told?
Well, you know, a couple of things, Lawrence. I was struck that when he was arrested for a crime in 1990, which was in New York City, which was one of the years of the highest murder rates in the city. So it was a kind of a time capsule of this moment. He was 17 years old at the time, and I met him in his early 40s. And since that time, he had been in prison. His whole adult life, he had been educated, got his GED, got his college degree, got his master's. And also it was a window into Sing Sing in particular and how they, if you have good behavior, they have policies that can be really supportive of continuing to have relationships with people on the outside. And that's how Renine was visiting Lawrence. That's how they fell in love after first dating when they were, you know, 14 years old. Decided to get married and were able to decide to have kids while he was in prison.
Lawrence, what made you decide, okay, I'm going to tell my story to this woman, as nice as Anna is? What made you decide you wanted to share your story?
Well, my story is my truth, and it makes it easier when you have a host that is so electric and kind as Anna. It's like a nice combination to have, and I felt comfortable. So when we began discussing things, and she was on point asking the questions that would dig deeper or asking the questions that would get a more insightful response from me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it almost felt like we were having a conversation outside of the microphones and the recording devices in place. That was one part of it. The other part of it is, after being incarcerated for so long, one can't help but soul search to kind of look into oneself, to kind of look at the past and what brought me to this point, and is this who my family wanted me to be? Am I making my dad proud? Am mm-hmm. I making my mom, my grandma proud? And what will my future be like? And in thinking about those things very deeply, I thought about my crime for many years, and I began to talk about it to other individuals around me, which was taboo inside of a prison setting. And I began to volunteer for various programs in which I kind of fleshed out certain feelings and certain things that I have done along the way in prison and my growth and maturity. So that made it easy to come into a space in where I discussed it with Anna.
Would you share with us what your crime was?
Well, unfortunately, in 1990, in December, I was watching a movie with some friends of mine, and another group of young men came in. They weren't even men. They were teenagers at the time. I was 17 years old, and an argument erupted between that group and my group of friends. And one of those individuals pulled out a gun and fired it at us. And this was a time where, as Anna mentioned, mm-hmm. I mean, to be specific, there was 2,242 murders in the city at that time. And if you want to compare it to Chicago of last year, I think Chicago 2017 was 650, and people always talk about Chicago.
How bad Chicago was, yeah.
Right. So that, I just laid that out so you could just understand the gun culture at that time. It was like even individuals who didn't want to be part of it would be sucked into it for protection purposes, and that's where I was in the situation. So I had a gun on me that night. So when the individual fired, you know, I felt the pressure to return fire, and I did return fire along with many other people in the movie theater. And as a result, one young man lost his life, and three others were injured.
One of the things, I have a friend who spent some time in prison, and we talk about it a lot, and he says, you know, sometimes it comes down to making a really bad choice. You're not necessarily a bad person. You were in a bad situation and you made a bad choice. Do you think that applies to you?
Yes, I certainly made a bad choice. I can't see myself at 40 years old carrying a gun, let alone being with individuals that carry guns, mm-hmm. and being in a situation where I'm arguing to a point where someone would shoot at me. That's just absolutely nothing I would be a part of now. So being a young person at that time and not being thinking maturely as I am now, and not being able to take responsibility for the things I've done, or being the teenager that should have been in school, which I was, but doing the responsible things at home, which is making sure the chores are done, or making sure that my little brother's okay, making sure that my mom don't have to come home to a dirty house, and planning my collegiate future. I wasn't doing those things. I was hanging out with individuals which I shouldn't have. Mm-hmm. So I can see why I made a bad choice. Not that it was an excuse, because it's not an excuse. I shouldn't have made that choice. But it simply was a bad choice.
So Anna, at first the series of episodes was a sort of a rumination on long-term incarceration, but the story changed as you got to know Lawrence and his family. Can you tell us about the different times that you checked in, and the most recent time you checked in right before he was paroled?
Yeah, so I met Lawrence in late 2014, and I remember when you first told me about Renine Lawrence, I said, "Who is this woman? I want to know who she is." And so it wasn't long after that I followed up with her, and she came to WNYC, and we did a segment on the Brian Lehrer Show about families of incarcerated, of people who were incarcerated together. And so over the years, Renine has been my sort of contact to Lawrence about, you know, what's going on with parole, how's everything going, how are the boys. So I was aware when Lawrence was preparing for his first appearance before the parole board. So last summer, I went and visited Renine, not long, Lawrence, I think after she had moved into the home with your father, with the boys, and talked with her about preparing for the prospect of Lawrence coming home and finally being out of prison and being together as a married couple for the first time on the outside. And then after that, Lawrence was not paroled after that first parole hearing. So I stayed in touch with Renine about that through last fall. And then Lawrence was a part of a lawsuit against the New York State Parole Board about the way that the parole board handles people who were arrested as juveniles for mm-hmm. crimes. And not long after that lawsuit was filed, the parole rejection was appealed. They heard an appeal, and he was subsequently let out on parole. And so then I was able to email with Lawrence for the first time. Very soon after we started emailing, he had a Gmail account. He didn't have internet access while he was in prison, and so we were in touch, and I got to see Lawrence and Renine together this summer as they were to talk about the jobs Lawrence is working, what it's like being a full-time parent now instead of just a weekend parent when the kids come up to visit, and hearing about what it's been like for them to adjust as a couple, because Renine's been very much holding down the fort on the outside, working, raising the boys, and to hear what it's like to now be together.
I want to dive back into that first time that you didn't get parole. You wrote a really beautiful piece for the Marshall Project about that time. Would you mind reading a little bit of that?
Sure. Leading up to my parole hearing, the men around me built up my hope for freedom, selfishly protecting their own. I was their champion, the one who had done everything right, as they say, and traded the hustle of the yard for homework in the school building. I took a risk in shedding the hard exterior prison culture encourages for something more human. If I couldn't get free, how could they? I bought the parole board my institutional file with my bachelor's and master's degrees, program certificates, employment records, community service acknowledgments, and letters of recommendation. They placed it right next to my 27-year-old criminal file, soberly reminding me of who I was. The boy who killed Jermaine Hall. So the question was, how do my accomplishments stack up against the fact that I had taken a life? Apparently they didn't. I was denied parole the first time I sat in front of the board. Everyone was shocked. Many men around me, around the facility, were disheartened and others angry, thinking about their own situation and how they'd fare. Officers were sympathetic, but me, I was defeated. I laid in bed and dreaded explaining the decision to my family. In the end, I found myself asking, what else could I have done?
So you sent in that you were defeated. What made you change that posture, that position? What made you decide, no, I'm not going to be defeated. I'm going to get out of here. I've done the right thing. I've served my time.
Well, I wanted to fight back. Mm-hmm. I believed I had earned my freedom. You know, I could never take back what I did, but I wasn't a person that was a threat to society, which the decision made me out to be. I knew that wasn't true. So I began seeking ways to appeal. And then one of the fears of many of the men and women in prison is if they stand up for themselves, they would be retaliated against mm-hmm. by the administration, or in this case, the parole board. So my fear was that if I were to appeal, the parole board would take it out on me and hit me with a two-year, extend my prison sentence for another 2 years. So that was my fear. And I remember talking it over with an attorney. His name was Jamie Clouser. And he mentioned to me that when I told him about my fear back and forth, and he kind of cursed at me. He was like, man, if you don't straighten up, you better fight back. What's wrong with you? I was like, he really let me have it. I'm like,
sometimes you need those people to come into your life, you know?
And it was interesting because I had just met him, and he just used all these expletives and like, yo, you better. And his famous thing, he said, only the squeaky wheel gets the oil. So you have a lot of errors with your parole hearing, and you need to kind of cry out about it in order to get the help. And he helped me in preparing my appeal, and I received the reversal of the decision. But unfortunately, Jamie Clouser passed away in June. He's a good friend of mine. Mm. His wife, Dana, is a beautiful, nice woman. His parents are great people.
You've only been out for a small, short period of time compared to the amount of time you spent in your whole adult life. Coming out, what's been challenging? Or would say, I'm sure a lot of things have been challenging. What have you found to be challenging or surprising as you try to create this next chapter of your life, Lawrence?
Well, I'll say challenging. Well, because it wasn't a surprise. I knew technology would be a feat to conquer. And so I began, as soon as I got out, my wife handed me a phone. So I dived into the phone trying to learn it. And the phone has, it's like a mini computer, sometimes more powerful than mini computers.
That must be freaky.
It was definitely freaky. But I promised myself that I wouldn't be daunted by it, that I would tackle it and I would succeed. So I've done that. And I know how to use my phone in many ways. But then I became employed. When I became employed and with the Corrections Accountability Project, the first, Bianca Tyler, the first one to give me a job. And I remember I had to fill out these tax forms. I mean, I've never been so frustrated in my life. At least I couldn't remember. It was just so frustrating doing it on the computer. Spent at least 3 hours, and then I didn't get it right. Kind of find out it was a code that I was supposed to be given and put in.
Newsflash, that's everybody.
That's what she said.
And I want to bring you in before we get wrap up. You know, your whole focus is on conversations people don't have about sex and death and money. As you see Lawrence and his wife, what is it about their relationship? Because you investigate a lot of relationships that you think has helped them be successful in the face of all this difficulty.
I think both Lawrence and Renine are remarkably, what makes them so wonderful to talk to in interviews, they're both remarkably self-aware people and very open, and they love each other, but they don't gloss over what's been challenging about this. You know, one thing Renine talks about in the latest episode is how after Lawrence's first parole denial, how she had a really difficult time with depression and needed to ask for help for the first time after being, you know, her whole identity has been around being the strong mother who's holding up the family while Lawrence has been in prison. And that was quite challenging for her. So I think hearing these two people who are trying to keep their family together under very extraordinary circumstances, who are really honest about what's tough, about regrets that they have, about what led them to what's happening in their lives now, and what it's like for them to try to, you know, start this new passage together as a family. It's just such a privilege that they let us into that story.
And Lawrence, you can't see him, Anna, but he's got on a suit and a shiny tie. It's very sharp. What's happening tonight, Lawrence?
Well, I've been planning an art exhibition along with a friend of mine, Bianca Tylik, for many, many months. And it's art featuring artists from all across the country that are incarcerated. And they put these beautiful pieces of art together. And tonight is a grand opening. It's a ritzy affair. That's why I'm dressed so nice. And I'm really looking forward to it. It's really going to be fun.
It's at the Urban Justice Center at 40 Rector Street, the 9th floor in Brooklyn, from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. It's the Corrections Accountability Project. I hope you have an excellent evening, Lawrence.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming to the studio. That's Lawrence Bartley and Anna Sale, the host and editor of Death, Sex, and Money. Thanks, Anna.
Thank you.
Bye, Anna.
Bye, Lawrence.
When we come back, we'll continue our examination of the various narratives around incarceration. Next up, a new HBO documentary called The Sentence. Stay with us. You're listening to All of It. Welcome back to All of It. We're going to turn now to a different story of love and incarceration. This story looks at a mother's love and the lengths that she and her family go to reunite her with her children. Filmmaker and cinematographer Rudy Valdez joins us now to discuss this documentary, The Sentence. The film's subject, Cindy Shank, is Rudy's sister. She also joins us in studio. The documentary looks at the impact of Cindy's mandatory minimum 15-year sentence she was given for conspiracy charges related to crimes committed by her now-deceased ex-boyfriend. Welcome to the studio, you guys.
Thank you so much for having
us. Thank you.
So, Cindy, can you explain to people how you ended up with a mandatory minimum sentence of 15 years when you weren't dealing drugs, you were just dating a drug dealer?
Well, yeah, absolutely. That's exactly what it was. Conspiracy is knowledge. So any knowledge that you have of a crime, you can be convicted of that crime. I did live with him and I knew what he was doing. I think because he was murdered, that's the only thing that I can think of why they went after me. They had nobody to charge the drugs to. Mm-hmm. So I was the one left behind.
And there's this moment when you say, and your ex-husband now, yes?
Yes.
That you heard a knock at the door and you knew what it was. Can you describe that day?
Yeah, it was, after he was murdered in 2002, I moved on with my life. I got married and had kids. And 6 years later, I get a knock at the door. And I guess it was just the intensity of the knock and how early in the morning it was. My instinct was to just go to my girls and, you know, hold them. And then I remember hearing Adam opening the door and hearing, you know, they had a warrant for my arrest. And it was just, something inside me, I don't know whether it was mother's intuition, you know, instinct, I knew. Hmm.
So Rudy, here you are, your brother, your sister, you're watching this happen to your sister. At what point did you decide, you know what, I need to document this?
Well, you know, I started filming the day after she went away, the day after she was sentenced, and it wasn't a documentary at that point. It was just me wanting to capture the girls, mm-hmm. you know, because, you know, at that point, I knew Cindy was given a 15-year prison sentence, and to be honest, I thought that there was a mistake and that it was going to be rectified and she wasn't going to do this 15 years. But until then, I was like, I need to capture moments so that she can watch them grow up no matter how long she's going to be away. So that's how it started, just wanting to capture these moments so that one day she could watch them grow up for however long she was going to be away. And then it sort of organically turned into a documentary. You know, it's funny, I can actually pinpoint the moment that it became a documentary. It's the first scene of the film. I was living in New York at the time, and I'd flown back to Michigan to film her oldest daughter, Autumn's dance recital. And, you know, I was just filming her get ready so that Cindy could one day see this, because I know Cindy wanted to see this dance recital so bad. Mm-hmm. And Cindy calls completely organically, completely unexpectedly, and she says this line to Autumn over the phone. She says, "Do you know what mommy's going to do while you go to dance? I'm going to lay down in my bed, I'm going to close my eyes, and I'm going to think about you." And it was that moment that I became a filmmaker. It was that moment that this became a documentary. You know, I realized that I had an opportunity to tell a story that you don't get to hear when you read the headlines about somebody being incarcerated or the amount of people, you know, sentenced under these guidelines and these crazy, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50-year sentences. You don't get to hear about the kids left behind. You don't get to hear about the families left behind and the communities left behind. And it was kind of this perfect storm, because during that time, you know, I like I said, I thought Cindy's sentence was a mistake. So I was researching and researching. And not only did I realize it wasn't a mistake, but it was happening to thousands and thousands mm-hmm. of people. So when I saw that interaction between Cindy and her daughter, I multiplied that by the thousands of kids who were having those same conversations with their mother or father. And I knew that I had to tell this story. I didn't know how I was going to do it, but I was going to figure it out.
And it's interesting, over the course of the film, we watch your daughters grow up.
Yeah.
And it's amazing when they start as just tiny little girls, and then by the end of it, yeah, you just rolled your eyes like, oh, she's a woman.
I mean, it was devastating to watch.
It was really, but it also just really, you got the sense of like, oh, what this family's been going through and for how long this family's been going through. So did you ever, did you guys discuss, like, should we be doing this with the girls? How did you feel about it when your brother said, you know what, I'm going to keep filming them and keep asking them about this?
Yeah, you know, I think early on we had this conversation about what it meant, and, you know, I think we both had this realization, him on the outside, like, figuring out, like, how big this is, and then I'm also on the inside, also had this idea that, you know, they made a mistake, I'm going to go home soon, but then I'm meeting all these women whose stories were exactly like mine, and I'm also coming to the realization that, wow, no, I'm not going anywhere, you know, they really want me to stay here. And then when he asked to make this a documentary, you know, obviously we didn't know it was going to turn into this, you know, nobody could have expected what it's happening. But, you know, I wanted somebody to tell our story. I wanted somebody to know what was happening, because before I was affected by the system, I had no clue about the system and I didn't know. And now I'm on the inside, you know, thinking, gosh, I want somebody to help. And now I have an opportunity to do that and to speak for us, for the women that were in there and still are in there. So, yeah, I think it was for it. We need to do this.
So you sort of decided it was for a greater good.
Absolutely.
I mean, a greater good is the perfect way to you know, encapsulate this. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a difficult decision to make this documentary. And I will say, you know, one of the things about this documentary is it was never going to be a documentary that I made for Cindy. It wasn't for Cindy or mm-hmm. for her cause. I was never going to stop filming and say, look, here's an example of one person who deserves to be let out. Mm-hmm. It wasn't an advocacy film for her. You know, Cindy was given clemency before I was done making this film. I could have easily said, we're done. Like, I don't have to put my family through any of this. I don't have to have them relive it. I don't have to have, you know, cynics come after them and say these things about them. I could have said, okay, enough is enough. But that would have been a disservice to Cindy. That would have been a disservice to my family, who was open and honest and willing to tell their story. And it would have been a disservice to the larger fight. You know, I went through with making this film with the permission of my family and Cindy and the girls and Adam, because it was always for a greater good, always. This was always about the larger systematic problem. You know, I was always going to film until Cindy came home, however long that was going to be, because I wanted to show time. Mm-hmm. I wanted to show ramifications of these sentences. And it was for the other people who were in there who didn't have somebody fighting for them on the outside. And that's who it's for now. The people who are left behind. The children who are left behind.
We're speaking with Rudy Valdez and Cindy Shang, brother and sister, about their new documentary called The Sentence. It will be on HBO on October 15th. Rudy, how did the rest of the family feel? It was interesting to watch your dad.
Yeah, you know, people often ask about how difficult it was to make this film, and I always reference filming my father, because I'll never forget the first time I was filming him, and I'm looking down at the viewfinder, and he starts to break down in front of me, and everything in my heart was saying to stop filming, put down the camera, and give him a hug, tell him it was going to be okay, tell him we were going to get through this, all of those things. And then something else started fighting me on the inside, and it said, hold your shot. This is for the greater good. You ask your family to be open and honest and vulnerable for you, and you promised them, I promised them that if they did that, if they allowed me to tell their story, that I would make something good. And these were the sacrifices. I was realizing in real time that this is the sacrifice, that I need to create this emotional barrier between me and my family. For 9.5 years, I created an emotional barrier through this camera, through this lens. And people say, what were the toughest parts? And there weren't any good days, you know, filming this. There was never like, wow, this is going to be a
shot.
Really fun
shot. That was a
shoot.
Nice setup. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Great right. job, guys. Really nice, nice tears, Mom. Way to go. Way to go with the tears, brother. Yeah. Like, it was never a good day, but it was also, you know, therapeutic in a lot of ways. For me, selfishly, it was very therapeutic and allowed me to have something tangible that I felt like I was always doing to tell a greater story. On top of the advocacy I was doing, it was this other thing that I was like, maybe this will help somebody else down the line.
Cindy, you were in prison for 9 years?
9 years.
9 years. You said you met a lot of other women who were in this similar situation. What do you think people don't understand about the situation that you and these women were in?
I guess they just don't understand, you know, how we're held accountable, how we are responsible for maybe somebody else's actions, or how, you know, we've been given these blanket sentences and, you know, we're categorized in one way. I mean, we're under these laws that are made for kingpins, and we are being charged the same way when we are, you know, very limited responsibility in what, you know, if any, actions that we played in these roles. But the sentences don't reflect that. You know, we're giving these huge sentences, and our families that are paying the consequences, you know, things that are suffering beyond just us. I mean, yeah, I'm in there, but you know what? I'm fine. You know, I have a roof over my head. I'm, you know, I'm eating and I'm sleeping and I'm going through the motions. And yes, it's hard, but my children are suffering. They do not have a mother. They do not have, you know, that.
Well, they do have a mother. They just don't have
not
access
a mother
to her.
There. You know, one of the hardest things for me to see was one of the realizations was, I said over years, I was like, you know, I'm a phone to them. I'm a phone, literally a phone. And that's one of the images that devastates me when I see it on the film, is mm-hmm. because the scene the girls gather around the phone is something that I always knew, but to see is like, you know, I'm their mommy. I'm always will be mom. But, you know, I have, you know, mother's there. Mother should be there. And that was one of the hardest things for me. And I know it was one of the hardest things for my daughters.
Well, let's take a little bit of a listen. This clip is from when you've been away for about 6 years. Let's listen in.
I'm in a federal prison camp in Lexington, Kentucky, 2014. But it's good, though. I think this is the closest that I've been to them. When I think about, you know, the girls before I came in, it's like, I'm trying to remember every little thing that they do, or, you know, every reaction or expression that they had, and it seems like the more I think about them, the more that those memories are slipping away. I feel like I've always been here.
You know, we're still trying to figure out a way to the clemency.
I know. But that's kind of way out there, you know? This call is from a federal
prison. Yeah, I'll never give up hope.
I know.
Rudy, how often were you able to be in contact with Cindy?
Honestly, not that often because, you know, she had a very limited amount of minutes a month, 300 minutes max a month, and they were in 15-minute intervals, and they cost,
they cost a lot,
money.
Yeah.
So whenever I was on the phone with her, I tried to make it as fast as possible because I didn't want to waste a single minute of her being able to talk to her daughters. So we would email quite a bit back and forth, but her phone calls were mainly for her daughters.
Do you think this is a film, this is either of you can answer this, that really only a family member could have made?
I think only Rudy could have made the intimacy that, you know, he mm-hmm. brought to the film, especially with the girls being, you know, that's Uncle Rudy, so they were very comfortable and, you know, with their uncle, so being able to speak and just open up, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I can speak to my family's experience, and I know that had I brought a camera operator with me to film my father or a producer or even another director or something, my dad wouldn't have talked. Mm-hmm. He wouldn't have opened up that way. My mom wouldn't have. It was the only way to make this film, which is why I became obsessed with becoming a filmmaker. You know, I learned to become a filmmaker to make this film because I knew I was the only one that was going to be able to capture these moments with my family in this intimate way. And I needed to try and be the best filmmaker I could be. So I think other people have made other films on this subject, on mass incarceration, on the war on drugs, on all of these things, and they're all valuable, and they're all a part of this conversation, but I felt like with my family, I was the only one who could have told this story.
No, I didn't expect it. I was watching. I didn't know anything about it. I just watched it cold that you were going to get out.
Yeah.
So I had there's this really kind of like amazing moment. It's difficult, and then all of a sudden it's like, whoa, she's coming home. She's coming home. How did you find out, and when did you find out?
Well, that's exactly how it happened. You know, I'm in the situation of not knowing, and just this, you know, long, just knowing I had to do this time, and I still had this hope that I might get it. I was actually in county jail. I was in transit to go to yet another prison.
How many were you in altogether?
Three.
You were in three prisons.
Yeah, and I was in transit heading to Alderson, West Virginia, which I found out later. I didn't know. They don't tell you during transit. It's security reasons. They don't inform you where you're going. They just know you're going. And I received a phone call, and you never get calls, or you never want calls in prison because, mm-hmm. you know, when you receive a call, it's 99% of the time always bad. So when I did get a call in, they called me out to the center pod, and there's women, you know, and they're all in these glass rooms around the top. And I get handed the phone, and I hear instantly my attorney's voice, and I hear it's Tatiana. And I said, you know, and I just held my breath because I knew that this was the moment, yes or no. And all she got out was congratulations. And I just screamed this release and fell to my knees, and I look up and all the women are like pounding on the walls because they think it's something bad because when you get a call, it's always bad. And then I just scream, I got clemency, you know, and it was just this great cheer. And people just, for me, it was just, I was shocked. I was numb. I was excited. I was ecstatic. I was thankful.
Mm-hmm. Rudy, can you share with our audience how unusual it is to get clemency?
Yeah, I mean, I was never good at math, ever.
That's why you're in the arts.
Yeah,
that's why we're all in the arts.
Exactly. I don't know that I've ever passed a math class, but the odds, I don't even know how to tell you what the odds, I'm sure there's an actual number of what the odds are, but what they felt like mm-hmm. were impossible. So much so that even after it happened, literally after she was given clemency and after she came home for months, I would wake up in the middle of the night and have this panic, and I would have to ground myself, and I would look at my phone, and I would have to physically look at a text from her to believe it happened. That even after it happened, I still couldn't believe it happened. Those are the odds.
Yeah, unbelievable.
Have your girls watched the film?
Yes, we saw it the first time together as a family at my mom's, you know, in the living room, and It was before he screened at Sundance, so it was just kind of, he, you know, let us watch it first, and it was, you know, we held each other through it. We cried and held each other through it, you know, just trying to comfort each other. So yes, they've seen the film, and it's hard, I think, for them to watch. Mm-hmm. You know, I've spoken with them about it, and it strikes conversation between us. Like, I know every time Anna sees it at night, we tend to have these kind of conversations, and she'll want to talk, and it'll bring things up, and yeah, we've seen it and we share it, and we, you know, we're still living through everything, you know, the ramifications, and I think we always will. I think it'll be it's part of us, and we won't know the real effects for years to come, how this really affected the girls truly in their lives. But I'm home now and I'm here with them, and I'm gonna do my best to love them and mother them and guide them through this. So
when you watched it, what was the thing that you didn't realize that you had missed in their lives?
So much. I mean, there's so much. I had to relearn everything, you know, from how much I got to tickle Annalise to get that dimple to come out, or, you know, I got to remember Ava doesn't like cheese, and, you know, there's just certain things that a mother should know, and I had to learn those things.
And really, what's next? I mean, the film is going to air on HBO, but I have a feeling, I get this vibe from you, this is bigger than just this day that it airs on HBO.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like the fight is just starting. You know what I mean? It's been a battle to make this film and to get it out there, and I think the battle for larger criminal justice reform and sentence reform is just starting, and I'm hoping that we are a part of this larger conversation. I hope that the film is a tool for other organizations who have been fighting for this for over 30 years. You know, it's not going to be one organization, one person, or one film that makes this change. It's going to be a collection of a lot of things, and I hope that we're a part of that fight and a part of that conversation.
The name of the documentary is The Sentence, and it's going to be on HBO on October 15th. Rudy Valdez and Cindy Shank, thank you so much for sharing your family story.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Stay with us at All of It. Welcome back to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. The third narrative about incarceration we're looking at today is about the transformative properties of performance art. The creators of the work we're about to talk about believe that avant-garde performance offers all people the space to dream and imagine, and their new work addresses the meaning of freedom, especially in the wake of serving a prison sentence and then reentering society. Their new piece is called Jack and will play at BAM as part of the 2018 Next Wave Festival from October 17th through October 20th. I'm very happy to welcome theater artist Kinesa Shal, thank you, and Nate Alston are in studio today. Welcome, guys.
Thank you, welcome. Allison.
Thank you.
So, Kinesa, tell us a little bit about your background in theater.
Yeah, so I come from traditions that involve weaving many different languages, mm-hmm. and lots of formal innovation that has come out of the American avant-garde. And for me, I think about, how do we think about not only formal and aesthetic languages, but how do we also think about historical and cultural and experiential languages, and that all of that goes into making performance.
And how did you and Nate connect?
Yeah, so Nate and I first met when Nate was starring in a production of August Wilson's Ma Rainey's Black Bottom in full drag in a sequin dress at an all-male correctional facility.
You looked fabulous. I saw the video.
Thank you very much. I think I was working it too.
He was. His performance floored me, and I thought, that is an artist that I want to work with. And I had heard through the grapevine later on that Nate was released, and tracked him down, and we started working together as artists on a project called Go Forth. Mm-hmm.
So Nate, when you were in this performance, this is when you were incarcerated.
Yes.
Had you always been interested in the theater arts, or was this something that came to you as a way to express yourself?
I had always been interested, but I really didn't have the courage to pursue it because, you know, growing up, I got into a different lifestyle. And so some of those interests that I had when I was younger kind of got pushed to the side. And then it wasn't, you know, and that culture, the thing to aspire to, mm-hmm. you know, so I got caught up in something else, but it was always there, you know. And then when I had the opportunity, I began to come in more into myself, I said, nah, I'm gonna explore this, you know, I got this, there's something I want to do, I'm gonna do it.
What was that opportunity? Was it a program?
Yeah, unfortunately, it happened when I was in prison, mm-hmm. and I was exposed to this program called Rehabilitation Through the Arts. RTA with Catherine Varkins, and it was at Sing Sing when I was at Sing Sing Correctional Facility, and they had started a theater program. And at first I wasn't going to get involved because I was involved in, you know, something else. It was positive, but I was involved in something else positive. But then I had an opportunity to be a part of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and I got the bug, and after that it was...
And you, what did you recognize in Nate as a performer?
Well, extraordinary artistry. I was captivated the entire time, and this piece we're working on has grown out of the kind of creative conversations that we started together. And we actually didn't get to premiere the first piece we were working on because of issues with the New York City Parole Board. And that got us kind of continuing to think about our artistic conversations and what it would look like to keep expanding them.
So your first collaboration was Go Forth, right? Can you explain that to folks?
Yeah, that piece was actually thinking about death and how we process and perform our relationship to death. And this has grown out of kind of continuing to think trauma and how do we think about dreaming after trauma.
And for you, Nate, what was it about that conversation about how to continue to have a fulfilled sort of dreamscape and dream life after something so difficult?
Well, actually, it was the arts that gave me my dreaming back, you know. As you know, incarceration, it kind of takes your dreaming, sometimes hope, et cetera. And it wasn't until I got involved into the arts. It's not that the arts made me want to do better, want to do good, but it gave me a venue to do so and to pursue those things that was inside of me that I wanted to come out. And so once I discovered the arts and I said, well, listen, you know what? I can dream of being before, I realized that it's something that I loved. So I can dream of being in front of an audience and dream of not only entertaining, but using the arts as an education because I begin to learn more about the arts. And the arts has always been used also as a form of education. So I said, I can use this venue, which is something that I love to do as well. And I seem to be halfway good with it. So, you know, so it gave me my dreaming back, and then it translated into my reentry, you know, so it was also part of my reentry.
I had worked on a project with some artists, who all of whom had been formerly incarcerated at some point in their lives for long periods of time, and what they all said to me in different times during different interviews was that when you're incarcerated, part of the process is stripping you of your humanity, right? You come down to a number, everybody's wearing the same thing, you have to do things all the same time, and that the art really helped them retain their individuality.
Yeah, my individuality and helping me to learn myself, you know, like, for instance, you can't put on a performance, like a full performance, and not learn things like community, responsibility, leadership, nonviolent resolutions, empathy, things of that nature. The arts will help you to realize these things, and it helps you to grow and learn these things about yourself. And so once I started, I'm doing these performances, I'm doing things, and the process of that is what gave me, you know, helped me to reestablish my identity.
And it's been interesting in our work on this and in bringing our ideas together, where some of that idea can grate at me a little bit in thinking about how the arts can be used as a colonial tool and get used as a way to teach someone how to act right. And this sense of Nate and I bumping up against each other and thinking about the ways that we collaborate as artists and all the languages that we bring together. And in making this team, everyone has brought all these wild, wild different materials into the room, from cotillion balls to the Honeymooners,
yeah, we gotta
talk
about
all paintings. And it's been fun to kind of have a dialogue together about how we think arts and that we bring different ideas to the table has been exciting.
That's sort of the definition of collaboration, right?
Yeah.
Like, you got to bring it and you got to respect it, and then you have to work it together. So the show is called Jack And. Mm-hmm. What does the title mean?
The title is Leaving Space for Dreaming. It is a loose reference to an organization in the United States called Jack and Jill.
I'm aware.
Yes. That we found out about through a very roundabout way. We were actually on a Google search trying to remind ourselves about the nursery rhyme. And And it brought up a lot of questions for all of us, thinking about particularly how we care for moments of transition.
So let's talk about the difference. It's in three acts, mm-hmm. right? Is that, correct me if I'm wrong. The first part's a monologue. What is the monologue, Nate? What is the essence of the monologue?
The monologue actually is taken from real life perspective, real life thing, and happens in a day room in prison, right, among mm-hmm. some guys who are exposed to the news. You know, some news comes on about, I don't want to give it up.
About an event,
right? And they give their interpretation of what actually happened, you know, in spite of what the news guy and everybody else is saying. They give their interpretation about what has happened. That's one of the dialogues. And then the other monologue is about also an event that happened in real life, about a guy who was, you know, made some decisions that wasn't so smart, mm-hmm. and kind of paid for it.
Would that be you? as you're tugging at your collar?
There's actually a story. We'll give a little piece. There's a story about a guy in Harlem who had a tiger in his apartment. He loved animals. He mm-hmm. had a tiger in an apartment. True story. And so Nate kind of recounts that story, and right. we talk about recipes for dreaming and how do you build the recipes for your life.
Right. And the second part is a little more traditional, in the sense that it's based on traditional sitcom tropes.
That's right. At one point early on in the process, a couple of folks kept bringing in the honeymooners. We had asked this question of who taught you to act right, and we were telling lots of mm-hmm. stories about our grandmothers, and then the honeymooners kept coming in, and all I could remember was kind of vague domestic violence overtones of "To the Moon, Alice." Mm-hmm. And eventually I was like, okay, fine, we'll watch the honeymooners. And in watching it, there was this sense of the sitcom as a fundamental form of American dreaming, that the aspirational class story structurally mm-hmm. is such a part of our national dreaming narratives. And so we began thinking about sitcom as a form for that second section.
And then the last section, as you alluded to, is this cotillion.
Yeah. The cotillion came around through a bunch of different ways. We wanted to think about cotillion as an entrance into society ceremony, and how to reimagine that as a re-entrance into society ceremony. And there was one artist we were working with who told the story of a Catholic priest who had taken a shine to him, and he had escorted a young woman to her debutante ball and done all the classes, and then 4 months later was put in prison for the rest of his adult life. And he was talking very specifically about what it means to spend your coming of age years inside, and how to think transitions, and how to rebuild intimacy. And we stuck on this idea of cotillion as a ceremony.
Now, why do you think, and why do you believe that avant-garde theater is a good good stage, pardon the pun, for telling these kind of stories, to tell these stories, specifically stories about people who have been incarcerated or who have been separated from their dreams?
I believe that great storytelling requires speaking many languages, and that those languages are expansive, and that we bring with us so many tools into a room. And really, the strongest tool of an ensemble is the culture of the group, and then that is comprised of the experiential and historical and cultural and artistic languages that people speak.
When you came to this process, to Kinesis' point, what did you want to bring from your culture, from your life that you've lived, the culture of Nate, to this process, and that you want people to take away after they see this piece?
I guess one would be recipes are important. No matter what it is that we're doing in life, we are always cooking up a recipe. There's a recipe for our success, and those ingredients will contribute either to our success or our disaster. Also, the fact that in spite of having your dreams deferred, dashed, crushed, as long as you have hope, as long as you continue to move, you can accomplish. You can reestablish your dreaming, and you can accomplish those dreams. Right now, I am living my dream. I have reestablished my dreaming, and I'm living it, you know, through the grace of God and people that he's put into my life. I'm living a dream. And if I can do it, pretty much anyone can do it, as long as you have the determination and the drive. and also that the arts is a great educational tool.
Nate Alston and Kaniza Shaw, thank you so much for joining us. The name of the piece is Jack Ann. It'll be at BAM as part of the 2018 Next Wave Festival from October 17th through the 20th. Thanks for being here, guys.
And thanks for having us. Thank you.
That is our show. Thanks for listening to All of Us. Join us tomorrow at noon on WNYC. All of It is produced by Megan Ryan, Rosa Guerin, Catherine Millsop, Andres O'Hara, Joseph Capriglione, and Ursula Summer. Matt Mirando is our engineer, and Luscious Jackson does our theme music. You can follow All of It at Instagram and Twitter at All of It WNYC.